Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Eminent Domain. Recorded in 2003, Dennis McQuestion, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Texas at Dallas, speaks with professors Richard Epstein, University of Chicago, Gideon Kanner, Loyola Law School, Julie Forrester, Southern Methodist University, and attorney Kenneth Wright about eminent domain. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
As you may know, under certain circumstances, a government entity may take your real estate from you. The concept is called eminent domain. Now, as you might imagine, this power is simultaneously necessary to the function of good government, yet threatening to those of you whose property is at risk. We have an outstanding panel. And perhaps the leading theorist on eminent domain is Professor Richard Epstein. He's a law professor at the University of Chicago. A prolific writer, he wrote this book, which is called Takings, Private Property and the Power of Eminent Domain, in the mid-1980s, and that's when I read it. Now, he joins us from a studio in Chicago. Richard, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Give that viewer, if you don't mind, sort of an overview of property rights and the power of eminent domain and why you've been so involved in this topic over the years.
Well, I mean, it's an exhaustive subject, but I think the simplest way in which to state it is that the government itself is an assembly of individuals. And a situation in which some people wish to have power which they exercise over others should not be something which is completely arbitrary. And so what you try to do is to say that when the government takes property, it has to do so only for certain limited purposes, and unless it has a powerful justification, it has to compensate. And in the kinds of cases that you're talking about here, the thing that we're worried about most is a situation in which a powerful entity says, look, I need the plot next door for a building extension or for a parking lot. The fellow next door doesn't want to sell it to me, so what I'll do is I'll pay the state the money, it will condemn the property, and then it will transfer the property over to me. And this is called the public use limitation, and the issue is whether or not, when this is done, it satisfies the requirement that all takings, when done by government, be for public use. And I think the Supreme Court's position on this is one which says if you can conceive, that's its words, any conceivable benefit that comes from this particular activity, we don't look any further. So that the word public use becomes public benefit, however indirect.
All right,
and this has led to a...
Now, let me stop
massive
you.
Amounts of abuse.
Okay, let me stop you right there, and I'm going to put up on the graphic here, which you can't see, Richard, but I'm going to read it because that public use thing is very important. The graphic number one, which is the definition of eminent domain, I'm going to read it for you here, that eminent domain, sometimes called condemnation, is the power of government agencies to acquire property for, and there's your term, public use, so long as the government pays, and that's just compensation. Now, Richard, back to you on the public use thing. You would agree, wouldn't you, that the government needs the power of eminent domain? And but what's happened to this whole concept of public use over time?
Well, I mean, originally public use meant that we take property in order to build a railroad which has to go through a certain parcel of land in order to be coherent, or we take land for a fort, or we take it for a post office, or we take it for a public park. But the idea that we should take the property and then transfer it to another private party to use it exactly the same way that they would have used it if they had purchased it voluntarily, in my view, goes too far. But starting in the 1930s, lower courts and later the Supreme Court said, if you can imagine that there's some kind of blight in a neighborhood or some constriction on the free supply of land in the neighborhood, then you could take the land and give it to somebody else. And the question that one is faced now is, after 50 years of this doctrine being in place, is there going to be a counter-revolution towards it? And there are signs in some state courts and in some lower federal courts that people are very unhappy about the situation where the government is just the cat's paw which allows one individual to take property from another and use it for his own private benefit, just like any other parcel of land.
Okay, I appreciate that. We'll be back to you in just a minute, but I want to introduce the
Sure.
people here in the studio. First on my left is Julie Forrester. She's Associate Professor of Law at Southern Methodist University, and she's of counsel to Thompson & Knight in that law firm's Dallas office. Julie, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And sitting next to Julie is Gideon Kanner. He's Professor of Law Emeritus at the Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, where he taught property, land use, eminent domain, and advanced appellate advocacy for 16 years. He's editor of a publication called Just Compensation, which is a monthly periodical on the law of eminent domain. Gideon, welcome to Dallas.
Nice to be here.
And I want to tell you, when I talked to Richard Epstein, first of all, he said that you were going to make him look like a moderate. He doesn't sound too much like a moderate right now. We'll see if you can live up to that reputation.
Don't believe it.
Okay. And sitting next to Gideon is Kenneth Wright. He's a board-certified civil trial attorney with Rogers & Wright, PC, where he concentrates in eminent domain and condemnation proceedings. Ken, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm pleased
now,
to be here.
Now, you knew Gideon. In fact, that's how we found him, is through you. Now, you're in a situation where you sort of work with people who are involved in this, but give me some sense of the other side of the table here, sort of this idea of when government properly uses this power of eminent domain.
Well, for our society to function well in terms of a civilized society, public use is an issue that's been since colonial times here in this country, where you needed a roadway. You needed, in the old days, they called it a poorhouse. So public uses were the prevalent doctrine, and public uses, unfortunately, in a lot of ways, have been constrained in other ways. But in theory and in fact, municipal buildings, power lines, pipelines, all of those arguably have a public use that allows our society to continue to develop and function.
All right, we have a graphic number 2. It has some of those uses that you're talking about. Now, so if we can see graphic number 2, it'll give you an idea of the kinds of things that Ken just mentioned that have to do with legitimate uses of eminent domain, and you can see them there. Schools, parks, roads, highways, subways, fire and police stations, public buildings, and then the one that's going to cause us a lot of consternation today, and that's the elimination of blight through redevelopment, which we'll get to in a minute. But I think, Ken, you say that you've sort of worked both sides of the street here with your clients, yes?
Yeah, I'm a practitioner. I've had the good pleasure of recently representing the city of Austin, who's acquiring a full city block for their expansion of their convention center. It's been quite contentious, and the use to which it's being devoted by the city of Austin is also contentious because there is a downtown community that would prefer that Austin be developed in a certain manner, yet we need such things as public parking. I mean, literally to get to your building here. I mean, if you don't have service parking, you don't have a parking garage, you're out of luck unless there's a lot of public transportation. So it can be quite contentious, but certain things that arguably are not desirable are nonetheless necessary for us to function, such as surface parking.
All right. Now, Gideon, you've been around this not only from a theory standpoint, from a teaching standpoint. You've been involved all over the ballpark here, primarily, I guess, representing people who have been on the other side of the takings issue. Give us some examples.
Well, the problem that's causing us all the trouble is that the courts have been overly tolerant when reviewing the definition of blight. What is blight, by the way? You can't define blight. I mean, it's kind of like, I know it when I see it, when you go into a real bad part of town and you see dilapidated buildings. But that isn't our problem. As a matter of fact, in many cities, there are slums which are not being redeveloped. Why not? Because the city authorities and the redevelopers with whom they work realize that if those places were to be redeveloped the way redevelopment works, the poor people who live in those parts of town don't have any money to spend in the shopping malls or whatever it is they're planning to build there. So they don't redevelop the slums, and what they do redevelop is the better parts of town that as often as not would probably be redeveloped without their intervention.
Well, now, let me stop you there, because you and I had a conversation on the phone a couple of days ago. We have an issue in Dallas now, not unlike places all around the country that viewer might be sitting in right now. We have a situation in Dallas, in a southern suburb here, in which the city is trying to take someone's property in the eminent domain provision, and they're going to pay them for it, and they're talking about paying them for it. And the purpose of it is to allow Costco to have either more parking or more roads or whatever. Now, does Costco constitute a public use?
Well, of course not. It's a big department store. Costco is kind of the 800-pound gorilla in this field that's been pulling this in a variety of places. And they lost two of these cases finally in California, both in federal courts, and I represented the property owners in one of them, where the cities would try to condemn perfectly good, unoffending property in order to turn it over to Costco for their stores. And that is not public use. Costco is no more public use than the corner grocery, except the grocery is smaller.
Well, now, if I'm Costco, let's just say I'm the 800-pound gorilla, and this piece of property I can't buy because nobody wants to sell it to me, I guess I'm probably just good enough. If I'm a big enough gorilla, I can go down to the city and sort of lean on them to help me, can't I? And then what happens?
Well, sure. You can do a lot of things that are immoral, some that are illegal, some that are borderline. But the question that we need to face is, has this process gone too far? That is the, the Latin phrase, reductio ad absurdum. That is, you can push things to such an extent that they stop making sense. Just this past week or two, the appellate court in Arizona struck down an attempt to take a brake shop in downtown Mesa in order to turn it over to another fellow who wanted to enlarge his Ace Hardware store. Now, come on. That is not public use.
Well, here's what happened, and Julie, you know this story. In fact, it was on 60 Minutes just a couple of weeks ago. 60 Minutes talked about three issues, basically. One issue was in Lakewood, Ohio. We have a supporter of ours up there who's one of our key guys named Bernie Baltic, who sent us an email. So you got to watch 60 Minutes. 60 Minutes is always taking our programs, by the way. I don't want to tell you, if you're watching right now, you're stealing our stuff. Anyway, we already had this thing scheduled, and he knew it. And he said, you got to watch 60 Minutes, because 60 Minutes is going to talk about Lakewood, Ohio. In Lakewood, Ohio, they had a series of neighborhood houses there, 100-year-old houses. They wanted to tear them down, the mayor did, so they could build high-rise condos so the city could have more tax revenue from the condos. That was number one. Number two issue had to do with Manhattan, of all places. A guy's family had owned a corner block in Manhattan for 100 years, and the government there is trying to condemn that so that the New York Times can build their own building there. And the New York Times would not come on 60 Minutes to talk about it. Can you imagine what the New York Times would do to somebody if they wouldn't comment on something the New York Times was writing about? Hello, New York Times. And then third issue, the third issue which I want you to comment on is the one he just talked about. In Mesa, Arizona, there was a Bailey's Brake Shop. It's sort of, I guess, the entrance into Mesa. And, of course, the city fathers want the entrance into Mesa to look the style of which they'd like to become accustomed. And they wanted to build not only the Ace Hardware thing, move it, but some other restaurants, et cetera. And they talked about that on 60 Minutes. And then, Julie, just last week, the court came down and said they found in favor of the brake shop. Tell us about that.
Well, the court found there wasn't a sufficient public use. And I think what we need to be careful about here is this politics? Is this city politics? Is this someone with some pull at City Hall coming in and saying, I want a private benefit and let's call it a public benefit? And I think that's what Gideon was talking about when he said, is it, you know, are there cases where it's just going too far? You know, there are a lot of existing cases about the idea of eliminating blight. In the Lakewood, Ohio case, the city had defined blight in order to condemn some homes. And the way they defined blight was homes that do not have three bedrooms, two bathrooms, or a two-car attached garage. Now, in my neighborhood, well, my neighborhood's certainly blighted because I do not have an attached garage, and I think most older neighborhoods don't have attached garages. So
most of New York City is blighted.
Yeah, well said, Richard. Thank you. Go ahead, Julie.
I guess, you know, I think that there's some benefit in being able to eliminate blighted areas. I mean, one of the things, and the New York Times case, the block that was condemned did have, I understand, five sexual businesses in that area. And, you know, Times Square, if you walked around that area in the early 80s, it wasn't a real nice area to walk around. I was there last April with my daughter, and I felt comfortable walking back to my hotel at night. So you know, maybe there is some benefit in eliminating blight if that's what's really going on.
Yeah, well, the definition of blight is a tough definition, Gideon. Talk to us about that.
There is no question that eliminating blight or maybe eliminating a concentration of porno shops is desirable. But we're talking about something else. The government has many powers in addition to eminent domain. And one of its powers is what's called the state police power. And that is not just the cops, it is the power to regulate society. And the governments, surely, municipal governments in particular, surely have a lot of powers to regulate the use of land, and they can enforce building codes, and they can see to it that blight is arrested, that it doesn't occur. Assuming, of course, I'm talking about true blight, not about this phony stuff where they called a two-bedroom house to be blighted. Therefore, the government is now telescoping two different powers into each other, or maybe three. Power of eminent domain, the police power, and the taxation power. They want to raise tax revenues, and there are certain ways of doing it. There are laws that govern that, and there is the power to regulate, which is to prevent blight and to force people to maintain their properties beyond a certain point. And finally, there's the power of eminent domain, which is acquisitory.
I got you. Now, Richard, go ahead. You wanted to say something there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is, to follow up on what Gideon said, the police power, insofar as it's relevant in this context, is really the power to regulate what's a public nuisance. And the right test to ask about this is whether or not, if a neighbor came through and tried to shut down the porno shop, he would be able to do so on the grounds of nuisance. And I think in many of these cases, the answer to that question is yes. If you ask whether or not he could condemn a two-family house or a family house with three bedrooms and only one bath, I think the answer to that question would be no. As to taxation, the key point to understand here is you could switch to a system of site value taxation, where it's the value of the land that gets taxed, not the value of the improvement. But the moment you do that, you have to do it for the whole city, not just for this one block. And the point there is you want to constrain the government, so if it makes a choice with respect to one targeted group of individuals, it's going to have to make that same choice with respect to everybody else. And typically, most local governments are very reluctant to adopt site taxation, even though that was a great cause in the late 1890s by Henry George.
All right, thank you. Now, Richard, I'm going to come back to you on the issue of compensation in just a minute. But first, Ken, I want you to explain to that viewer what the process typically looks like. And let's take an example here. Let's say that person owns a piece of property where there's a street right-of-way involved, street or highway or whatever, which is a fairly simple process. What's the process look like, and what could that person expect under the best of circumstances?
Under the best of circumstances, ordinarily, you have a public referendum of a need, and then the first order of business is the acquisition of the land, and they try to do it voluntarily. They'll hire independent right-of-way agents, and they will ostensibly make you an offer. It should be predicated upon an appraisal. There is a model eminent domain code. In the old days, and I've seen it happen, where a condemnor could suggest that the just compensation was $10, but yet maybe you had an appraisal for $20. That shenanigans has kind of gone by the wayside. There's a public disclosure. So in theory and in fact, you should be made a good faith offer, have an opportunity to negotiate, taking into consideration not only the use to which the property they're taking is to be devoted, but also all the effects that it has on your remaining property. And at that point, if the negotiation period ceases, you cannot agree. In Texas, we have an administrative phase. It can be quite harsh. The federal government has a quick take statute called under the Declaration of Taking Act, where they can say, I've just condemned your property. We have a check waiting on you in Tyler. Come get it. Whereas in Texas, they make you an offer. We have an administrative hearing first, which when you cannot agree to the amount of compensation, and that's what it's designed and calculated to do, is to, number one, fix the compensation, and number two, allow the government access, or the condemnor rather, access to the property they need to begin their process. They must necessarily put that money up after the hearing before they have the right to possession of the property. You ordinarily ought to make certain when they're going to be out there, and sometimes it requires a court hearing. And then in Texas, you have roughly a three-week period of time to appeal that decision to a trial court de novo, where a jury determines it all afresh. So in Texas, I say it's a fair system. It can be harsh, but I like it a lot better than just, we have a quick take, here's your money, it's all over.
Now, Gideon, how does this compare with other places in terms of the process?
Texas has this additional step of the commissioners, but The usual procedure is that the government is required to make an offer, and if they can't work it out amicably, they file a lawsuit, which is, looks and smells and walks and talks like a civil lawsuit, except it's called eminent domain, and it requests the court to convene a jury to determine the compensation. And each side gets to put on its appraisal evidence, and the jury then decides what the compensation should be. Two or three states don't use juries, but most of them do. The problem, however, is, I know you mean to talk about compensation, so this may be a good time to jump into that, is that the compensation that is awarded in eminent domain, even though it is called just compensation in the Constitution, isn't. That is, in the law of eminent domain, you will find all sorts of losses that are inflicted on the property owners whose property is taken that are not compensated for. Mind you, courts say, oh, well, that's non-compensable. Mind you, that does not mean that they didn't occur, those losses didn't occur. They did. But the courts say, well, even though they occurred, we're not going to pay for them. And of one more point, and of particular moral depravity, is the position of the courts that if you have a business and your property is taken, and in the process your business is destroyed, you don't get one nickel for the business. You get paid for the dirt and the bricks, but not one nickel for the business.
So it's just the real estate. Richard, go ahead.
Yeah, no. Gideon is actually the fellow who first put me on to eminent domain when he wrote this thing up in 1969 in some law review. But let me just list some of the costs that are incompensable to explain why it is people so fear the eminent domain power, notwithstanding just compensation. First off, is you want to run an appraisal on the other side to see whether it's worthwhile. Sorry, it's not going to be compensable. Secondly, you got a lot of premature moving expenses to get out of this location. Sorry, it's not compensable. Third, you're going to lose goodwill because your customers won't follow you when you go to the new location. Sorry, it's not compensable. By the time you're done with all of these so-called consequential damages, you can easily have a perfectly just finding under the law, which gives you 50 cents for every dollar that you've turned out to lose. And as Gideon said, these are real losses that you have suffered. And in order to make this thing work correctly, you have to cover all of the costs that are imposed by the government, which is what you would do if a private party muscled you out of the land without any just compensation. So that if you change those rules, you would put less stress on the public use requirement, because as the price goes up, the willingness of the ace to condemn the brake shop next door is going to be correspondingly diminished. And so getting the right signals to government on compensation is critical to reducing the stress on the public use limitation.
Yeah, I appreciate that, because it's not just the public use, it is the compensation. We're going to come back to that, but right now we have a comment or a question from the audience.
Good faith offer versus fair market value. I ask that question to Ken first and foremost, because the one word that I do not hear or have not heard yet in our discussion this evening is the term taxpayer. Okay, Ken, in your line of business, how often, or if you could break it down to percentage, what is the ratio of good faith offers versus fair market values, and where do they match up?
You have to understand my perspective. I principally represent landowners, so I see a lot of what I would call unfair offers, lack of good faith, but again, that's my perspective. Having said that, there's a doctrine in law that the fact of the matter is it should be predicated upon an appraisal. The problem there is oftentimes they use the factors to distort the process, such as using comparable sales that don't square up to your property, those kinds of things. So it is kind of like public use. It's lip service, but the courts get past that. It's usually a situation where it's quite subjective. An appraisal, and you need competent appraisal help throughout the process, is a very subjective. Believe it or not, the data can be utilized in various fashions to kind of distort that process if necessary.
Gideon? Let me put it this way. I don't know what the custom is in Texas, but in California, it is the custom that lawyers who handle these cases get paid on a contingent fee. And the contingency is calculated on the overage.
Brian.
Not on the whole thing, but only on the excess that they collect for the property owner over and above that offer. Well, it follows that if those offers were generally fair, we'd starve to death.
Be out of business.
But I assure you that we eat rather well and regularly. So I will give you just one example. This is the most horrific example I know. It's a case in which I was involved, in which the California Department of Transportation condemned a chunk of a transmission line owned by the Southern California Edison Company for a freeway. They deposited into court $250,000. The jury verdict was $49.5 million.
Wow. Now, let me get that straight. $250,000 versus $49.5 million?
That is correct.
Yeah, it can happen all the time.
You say it does happen all the time, Richard?
Yeah, what happens is, what they're saying is, we'll figure out what the cost of the wire is that we're taking, and what Commonwealth Edison is allowed to do is to figure out what the losses are to the operation when they have to construct alternative facilities to yield the same amount. I give you another case. Is I worked on a case where the government was occupying the first floor of a large building which had been taken over by the owner and ready to rip down, and they wanted to extend the lease 6 months so that the rest of the building couldn't be altered or touched. And they offered to pay 6 months' worth of rent, and they didn't want to pay anything with respect to the loss of the value for the other 24 stories. They lost that case, but you had to go to court in there to get to win it. So whenever you have interconnections between the property taken and the property retained, the government estimates will always be big, low-ball estimates.
Well, the thing is, I mean, Julie, from my standpoint as a taxpayer, maybe I want the government to offer a small amount, because ultimately it's going to have to come from the taxpayer anyway. So, you know, that's one way to look at it. What do you think, huh?
Well, I guess as taxpayers, we don't want the government paying more than fair market value. But I think we all want fairness, too. I think we want people to be fairly compensated and justly compensated.
Well, I have heard of situations, Julie, and I know you're going to be shocked to hear this. But I have heard of situations in which landowners were able to extricate from the taxpaying entity a significantly larger amount of money than the property was actually worth, number one, and then secondly, end up with land on a freeway which was then valued at 10 times what it was before they sold that piece of property. Does that ever happen, Julie, and where's the fairness there?
Well, I'm sure it does happen. I mean, if the condemnation is for a highway, well, in some cases, people don't want to sell their property, and they're being compensated for what they have for the fair market value of their property. And then you're right, they have a remainder that's on a highway and becomes more valuable. But if it's a home they lost and now they've got property they can sell for commercial purposes, you're right, they've got a lot of money.
But, a lot of negotiation going on here.
Yes,
and Gideon, they just sort of need people you to help them,
not
don't
so
they?
Fast.
Sounds like another lawyer's relief act to me. Huh?
Not so fast. First of all, there's no question, we all know, that justice, as administered by the courts, is far from perfect. So there will be some cases in which one side or the other overreaches, and some cases in which they get away with it. But getting back to your example about that piece of property gets more valuable, there is a doctrine in the law of eminent domain called benefits. And that means that if you take a part of the property and you leave that other lot that adjoins the freeway, the appraisers calculate the increase in value that that property will experience after the freeway is built, and that is offset against the compensation that the owner gets for the property that was actually taken.
Now, does that actually work that way, Ken? Just a second.
In federal law, in federal practice, in theory and in fact, they can owe you nothing for your property. Let me give you an example. You have a reservoir, and you have a remainder next to that reservoir, and they just happen to build a marina right next to your remainder, and yet they acquired 100 surface acres of your valuable property. It was aesthetically pleasing anyway. They don't owe you a dime under federal theory. So the door kind of swings a little bit both ways. I've seen, rarely in my experience have I ever seen a landowner overcompensate. I mean, that's a rarity.
Okay, I agree with you. Now, Richard, go ahead. You were going to say something.
Yeah, I mean, occasionally there are, and you could tell by the following very simple test. Do people clamor in such a way as to make sure that their property will be condemned? when they wanted to build the new Comiskey Park, they were giving such lavish packages that people used to beg for their land to be included in the condemnation area. And that's a sign that you've gone too much on the top end. But I agree with Ken. In all the cases that I've heard of, those are oddities, and the routine situation is the difference between market value, which is relatively low, compared to owner's loss, which is almost very greater. The mere fact that somebody doesn't want to sell his property suggests that at the very least to him it's worth more than market value. But that subjective use value is never compensated under orthodox doctrine.
Now, Richard, am I right about this, that the idea of just compensation really is dependent upon what the value is to the person who owns it, not necessarily what the value is to the government entity or whoever ends up with it? Is that right, basically, as a doctrine?
Well, it's pretty close to accurate. There are a couple of variations. The first point is this consequential damages loss. I mean, the value of the land may be worth only $1,000 to you, and the business associated with it may be worth $10. And the issue is whether you compensate for only one or for both. And both Gideon and I believe that if both are going to be lost, you compensate for both. But the other qualification is this. Suppose, in fact, the only value you really attach to this land is the ability to hold up the government for all that you can in order to get the property, in order to extract from it again. Generally speaking, when you figure out what market value is, you figure it out independently of the value of the property to the government agency that's condemning it. And for the most part, courts have rightly and rigorously enforced that doctrine. It's the other doctrines on consequential loss that are the wrong ones, not the doctrine which allows people to hold out for a huge sum of money when they have land which is worthless for every purpose except the one that the government wants to use it for.
Good. Thanks, Julie.
Well, another problem that can come up, and that has, I know, in Texas, is if the government announces a condemnation too early, then that announcement can affect the value itself. If the knowledge of condemnation or of pending condemnation makes the value of the property go down, then should that new fair market value be the amount of the just compensation? And hopefully courts avoid that problem by, at least there's a Texas Supreme Court case says that the government can't reduce the value of your property by telling everybody they're going to condemn it and then come in and argue that it's worth less.
Okay. Gideon, you're nodding.
The tragedy is that when you have truly bad, this is called pre-condemnation blight, when you have truly severe cases like that, the tragedy occurs when the property owners lose the property by foreclosure, because the tenants move out, there's no income, the property can't be used, and eventually they can actually lose the property by foreclosure. And I've handled one case like that.
Ken, you're not
yeah, the
your
right.
We've seen it happen with, say, a retail shopping center. You get an empty glass syndrome, your rents go down. Having said that, TxDOT does have a quick take where you can ask because of hardship. You know, there are, I'm not saying it's the end all to be all, but TxDOT, for example, the Texas Department of Transportation will allow you to apply for hardship to try to get fast track. But in governmental time, fast track is still a real slow track.
Richard, go ahead.
Yes, it's very. First of all, what Gideon says, that the value of the property starts to go down once they condemn it, that's pretty good evidence that the compensation system isn't askew. If you were giving fair compensation, the value should be completely unchanged one way or another. But one of the things that this does is it absolutely freezes you on interim use for fear that any increment you make after they've announced it is not going to be compensable. And what the right rule is probably is one that says, look, the government wants to get an option on land, let it do so like any private party. Buy the option or condemn the option. If it takes the land, it doesn't have to pay for the increment. And if it doesn't take the land, it forfeits the option price. That would change a lot of these abuses for the better.
Okay, thanks. Here's a comment or question from the audience.
Oh, I had a question for, I guess, Ken or whoever could say. I'd just be interested to know how many of these cases are decided by special commissions and how many are decided by courts. Because I've had some experience as a special commissioner, and to me, it's a totally unreal experience. But
I had an unreal experience with that yesterday, but that's a sore subject matter. But in my experience, the special commissioner's hearing is designed and calculated as an alternative dispute resolution mechanism. But once you've gone that far, ordinarily it rarely resolves it, because you're already at loggerheads, and usually somebody comes out of that decision-making process bitterly disappointed. So therefore, I would suggest to you that most of these cases in Texas get resolved when you're in litigation beyond the special commissioner's court proceeding, but prior to, say, a jury trial.
All right, and speaking of the jury trial and the actually legal issues, Gideon, you're very, I would say, non-complimentary to the judges in this whole process. What's the problem here?
Well, that's a very excellent. I understand the judicial thinking on the compensation side. I do not understand why they have gone to the extremes that they have gone in destroying the meaning of the phrase public use. But as far as compensation is concerned, there's pretty clear historical understanding that unlike Western Europe, when the railroad era came along, this was still pretty much a vacant country. And a lot of the farmers were eager to give land to the railroads because they were hoping that this would bring prosperity. So that the initial culture here evolved as viewing the person who claimed compensation for land with suspicion. What happened, of course, was that times have changed, but judges, in the nature of things, tend to be old men, and now they're increasingly old men and old women. So their sensibilities are usually formed in the preceding generation. And when the people first started asking for money for their land in this country, they appeared in front of these old folks who looked with displeasure at these greedy people who wanted all that money. And from this, there has evolved a kind of a judicial culture that is still with us. Of course, the corruption of the railroad construction era didn't help matters any either. So we, in effect, have this part of the law has been polluted by a lot of historical moral garbage.
Well, I can't Yes. believe that you were saying that there was some mismanagement and corruption in the old days with railroads.
I mean, yes, isn't that shocking?
Shocking. I'm yes, shocked yes. that gambling could be taking place right now. There's another kind of taking, so to speak, Julie, that while I work my way back here to this lady's comment or question, it has to do with regulations or regulatory taking. Tell us a little bit about that and why that could be just as bad for some people as others.
Well, traditional view of eminent domain was that the government would decide to take a piece of property in the sense of taking full ownership of it and paying just compensation to the owner for that. Since later on, the courts have decided that there are circumstances in which the government may regulate property in a way that it really is like a taking. There's a wonderful New York case, and I think this is a good example because it helps you understand. There was a case in which an apartment complex had a private park there with the apartment complex, and the owners of the apartment complex wanted to build new apartments there. And the city of New York decided, and I think some of the owners or some of the people in the other apartments were wanting this also, but the city of New York zoned the private park as public park. Now, if the city of New York wants a park, that's certainly a public use, public purpose. There shouldn't be any problem with the city of New York condemning that property to be a public park. But when the city of New York zones property as a public park, it seems that the city is trying to figure out a way to take the property without paying for it at all. And that was the idea.
Again, from a taxpayer standpoint, Julie, sounds like a heck of a deal to me. Don't have to add on to Central Park. We just condemn it through regulatory matters and take it through regulatory. Richard, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, but on the other hand, there are many cases that are even more insidious than that. When the granddaddy of the regulatory taking doctrine came out the other way around, it was a case called Euclid against Ambler. It was decided in 1926. And there was a 68-acre plot of land between two railroad tracks on which somebody wanted to build a Fisher body plant. And they zoned that for single-family housing, knocking out 75% of its value. And so the question is whether or not when you stop uses that are in no sense ordinary common law nuisances, does that fall within the police power? And the great battle over this particular area is whether or not any of these cases, whether it's a small or a large decrement, should be compensable. The case that Julie gave was one in which there was a complete wipeout of private use. The Supreme Court today will go along, But when it's a 95% wipeout or a 72% wipeout or an 88% wipeout, all of a sudden they're at a complete quandary as to what's going to happen. And the great puzzle is, why is it that a complete elimination of all uses is compensable, whereas elimination of virtually every valuable use save one is in fact not compensable?
Well, that's an issue that I would assume, Gideon, you get involved in, and can you get involved in
yes.
all the time, is that right?
I have been involved in a number of these cases in the U.S. Supreme Court and elsewhere, and that is, at the moment, that's a hot issue.
What do you do? I mean, do you see this tide sort of swinging toward more on the private property side and less on government, or where are we where's the pendulum swinging these days?
The U.S. Supreme Court has imposed some limits on this sort of thing, but it has not been very forthcoming in favor of the property owners. What we can say with some degree of confidence is that where the regulation is so severe that it eliminates all economically viable use of the property, that's a taking. Where the regulation requires physical entry and use of the private property, that's a taking. And once you leave these two clear-cut areas, you wind up in a morass of balancing tests and factors. Some courts, like New Jersey and California, have come up with laundry lists of as many as 10 factors that have to be considered in order to establish that the property has been taken. Well, this is an enormously complicated process. It is an enormously expensive process. And the state of the regulatory taking law right now is such that, except for a few subsidized test cases, the only people who can afford to avail themselves of their rights under the Constitution are people who are enormously wealthy, very patient, and who have a very large budget to be spent on litigation.
And that's not an easy
thing to do. And a little suicidal.
suicidal thing. Here's another comment from the audience.
My question goes back to the issue with the New York Times. It sounds as though the New York Times will probably win their case and get the property that they want. What kind of arguments will they use? Are they constitutional arguments? Because we're back to the question of what constitutes blight. I presume they're going to say that they'll be cleaning up that area of New York and making it a nicer place for people to walk through?
Well, it'll be part of it.
Go ahead, Gideon, now I'll get Richard.
First of all, I have a point of personal privilege here. When you mentioned that I'm even more gung-ho than Richard, that is not entirely true, Richard. What happened is that I am a lot more outspoken than most lawyers are, who are afraid of judges because they have to go to court. And for many reasons, I've decided to be candid about it. So I will say some things very bluntly. And one of them is that when it comes to this topic, the property owners in the state of New York have no rights whatsoever. They're fifth-class citizens. New York courts have decided cases against them that are just absolutely mind-boggling. There is a case called Yonkers versus Morris, where the Otis Elevator Company wanted Morris's property, so the city condemned it, ignoring all the procedures. And Mr. Morris went to court, and he objected, and he wouldn't even get a hearing on his objections. The highest court of New York, the Court of Appeals, upheld that and told him that he was standing in the path of progress. Then Otis got the property 5 years later, moved out of town, and left the city holding the bag.
Well, good for the city is all I can say. Richard, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, look, with respect to the narrow question on the New York Times, the key point here to remember is there's a doctrine known as rational basis review, which says that we give enormous deference to what the legislature says. So since nobody knows what the word blight means, we have to trust it to the political process to define it. And I think the right answer to that question is, whenever you give rational basis review, you're throwing the keys to the kingdom to the very people whom you're supposed to regulate, to wit the legislature, which is capable of abuse, and you have to be tougher on it. And the New York courts, for the most part, have not. But there is light at the end of the tunnel. Just the other week, the Institute for Justice, with whom I've worked for many times, won a big case in New York where it turns out that the practice was they would basically publish in the newspaper a notice saying, we're going to condemn your land at some time, and never send actual notice to the real landowner so that he could actually be in a position to fight this. And the Second Circuit, in one of these decisions, says that's just plain unconstitutional, a violation of due process. And it turns out that they would knock down the statute. And ironically, Governor Pataki, a Republican, said, I thought this was a terrific statute because it allows me to take land on the cheap. So what's happening in New York has been pretty bad. There may be something of a groundswell moving in the other direction. And I would say that the odds are with the New York Times, but since the merits of the argument on that side is so weak, they may yet be suffer a comeuppance. It's a long shot at this point, but it's one devoutly to be wished.
Here's another comment or question from the audience.
I'd like to direct this to Ken. What we've heard here is that the courts have expanded what they define as being a public use to the point of not actually being public uses. They've also narrowed the definition of market value to eliminate substantial portions of what should be compensable in terms of the panel here. Where is that going in terms of private property rights? What does that mean for the future of this process?
I'm not terribly optimistic about Texas in terms of the local scope because our Texas Supreme Court, who they are elected officials, they seem to want to take care of the public fist, so they guard the taxpayers' money with very hard. Having said that, I would suggest that at least in the U.S. Supreme Court, at least I see a glimmer of hope. I mean, there's much more lip service being given to private property rights, so. It's kind of incongruent, Brian. The fact of the matter is that in Texas, we continue to create legal fictions that denies a private property owner full compensation. And I'm just talking about a simple real estate play. The fact of the matter is that certainly there are no business profits, any goodwill that a landowner in Texas is compensated for, but just a simple real estate play, the landowner's on the short end. Unless there's a sea change in our Texas Supreme Court, I think taxpayer wins. Individual property owner loses.
Julie, let me, I don't know what inverse condemnation is. You may want to address that. But I'd also like you to address just a bit about what happens in a bankruptcy situation, especially for secured creditors. Can there be a taking there, depending upon what the bankruptcy judge does in terms of secured versus unsecured creditors?
Okay, well, those are two kind of separate questions. But first on inverse condemnation, when the government decides to take a piece of property and to own that piece of property, the government institutes a procedure. And Ken told us a lot about that procedure in Texas. Sometimes the government just regulates or just, you know, if the government, instead of instituting a condemnation proceeding to widen the street in front of your house, just widened it, then you would be the person filing the lawsuit. If you're the person, if the property owner files the lawsuit, that's what an inverse condemnation is. The term comes up a lot in regulatory takings because those are the situations where the government has regulated instead of starting a condemnation action, and it's the landowner saying what you have done is essentially to exercise the power of eminent domain and take my property. So I'm going to bring the lawsuit.
And zoning is one of the instances of which you mentioned earlier. We had the case that Richard was talking about. But zoning happens almost every city in the country, with the exception perhaps of Houston, who still has some private property issue there. But for everybody else, I mean, sometimes zoning works to the property owner's benefit.
Right.
They want it zoned, no doubt about that.
Well, certainly.
They want their neighbor's property zoned.
Right, their neighbor's property. Right, go ahead.
I mean, in most cases, attacks against zoning have not been successful. I mean, first of all, there's the idea that property owners do benefit. There's a doctrine that the Supreme Court talks about called the idea of reciprocal benefits. I can't build a gas station where my house is located, and that's a limitation on my property rights that, in a sense, reduces the value of my lot. But my next door neighbor can't do that either. And so I'm benefited by the fact that all of my neighbors are in the same way limited. And that's what I want for my house. I think there are more questions that come up when it's a developer who owns an entire tract of land. Maybe the developer had planned on building a house on each quarter acre, and the land is downzoned so that the developer is only permitted to build one house per acre. The developer feels like I've lost a lot of money because my property's worth less. I can't make as much money now. And for the most part, those types of reductions in value have not been compensated.
Okay, and then just for that person who might have an interest in the bankruptcy side, give me about 30 seconds of what a taking in bankruptcy would be for a secured credit. We have had a few bankruptcies in this country in the last couple of years that you may be familiar with. Enron, I think, is maybe one of the people we talk about. What happens in those situations?
The issue that comes up in bankruptcy really has to do with secured creditors, lenders who have liens on property, which are treated under current bankruptcy law, which are given deference under current bankruptcy law. Lenders with secured creditors may be delayed in being able to foreclose in a bankruptcy where a person isn't making the payments. But for the most part, lenders come out of the bankruptcy with the same interest. The question has arisen as to whether changes in bankruptcy law could eliminate the rights of secured creditors, could basically say that we don't recognize liens in bankruptcy. I take the position that that would be a taking.
All right. Now, Richard, we only have about 3 minutes left on your satellite, so let me pose this sort of last question to you. One of the issues as it relates to public uses is, and it's something that has affected a lot of cities around the country, and that's the idea of sports arenas. The city goes into and condemns property and or makes way for sports arenas. Yet, got any thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, the first one is just simply a fiscal question. It's very difficult when you look at all of these deals to find any of them that makes sense from the point of view of the city. The argument is always made that what they do is they bring various kinds of collateral benefits when people congregate about the sports events. But if you're running baseball games or football games a dozen or two dozen times a year, they're going to be 200 and 300 days when that's not around. And even when it turns out that the sports are going to attract certain people, it's going to shut down other kinds of events. So almost invariably, when you look at these things, the team gets richer and the public itself gets poorer. Trying to mount a constitutional attack against this has proved to be a horrendous undertaking. You're not going to win on public use if it's a condemnation of private property. And many of these things, like the one which took place at Soldier Field, is in fact dealing with a redevelopment of public property, which is then given on very favorable terms to private property. I was part of a movement trying to sidetrack that rather unfortunate transaction, which resulted in a $600 million loss to the public and a $300 million gains to the Bears. And we lost 7-0 in the Supreme Court on the grounds that deference to the city fathers is all that's appropriate. So that's kind of at the edge of the eminent domain issue. That's probably a question that deals a little bit more with public finance. I think we ought to be very critical of those things and to remember, every time you give a subsidy to somebody, you give a detriment to somebody else by way of a tax burden. And if you're trying to figure out the social calculus, you can't do what the courts do, which says, let's look at the benefits and rejoice. You have to look at the benefits and the cost. And almost invariably, when you give the comprehensive measure, these comprehensive public projects don't make any sense.
Well, and the other thing that happens is it didn't make the Chicago Bears a better football team either, Richard.
Well, they won this weekend.
And I'm real sorry about that. Yeah, well, the Dallas Cowboys are on their way back now. Back from where, we don't know, but we'll see. Richard, thank you so much for joining us. We're about out of satellite time with you, so I appreciate your being with us. And
thank you so much for having me. It was great to visit with everybody anonymously.
Okay, thanks so much. All right, now back to the other issue. We just have a couple minutes left. Ken, sure. What is it that we ought to know and that viewer ought to know that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, I just think that what the viewer doesn't know is that simply you're seeing the tips of the iceberg here. I mean, as Gideon has mentioned, it takes usually a wealthy individual that would like to challenge somebody on a public use concept. You don't hear the story about all the people that are forced to settle because I'm going to have to go hire a lawyer. I'm going to have to pay an appraiser. So you're really just seeing the tips of the iceberg. Years ago, a right-of-way agent told me, well, we get 90% of the property, so I'm only seeing 10% of the cases in a lot of the public projects that are going on.
That's amazing. Now, Julie, what would you say to someone watching who has this? I mean, it might be something as simple as widening a street. It might be something like a Costco situation. It might be a sports arena. It might be something that is public or not public. What do you say to them in terms of what they should do right away?
Well, they need to hire an attorney. I think that's a good idea. And, of course, if you can't afford it, that's a real problem.
But the attorney usually, I mean, I think what you're saying is, Gideon, of course, in some cases you can only work on the amount of money over and above what was originally offered. But Julie, wouldn't you say in most cases the attorney is probably going to be able to get the property owner a better deal than what they can get otherwise or not?
Probably so, but in some cases maybe pretty small also, not involve a lot of money. I assume that there are cases that Ken turns down.
You have to be economic. I've handled cases from $50 to $50 million. You have to be economic, but then again, we don't always do it for money.
That's right. Sometimes you take cases because they're right. But as time has progressed and the practice of law has become more economically burdensome, the overhead of lawyers has just soared out of sight. Fewer and fewer lawyers are able to handle the small cases. And also, in fairness to the government, a great many of the offers that are made are reasonable. You may quarrel with them, but they're reasonable. And some are perfectly okay. And those people never wind up in court. It's only that 10%. I would also emphasize something that's been touched on, and that is that one of the big, remember, when you walk out of court with that judgment, the judgment says the fair market value of this property is, let's say, $100,000. But you don't get $100,000 because from this you have to deduct your attorney's fees, your appraiser's fees. There are all sorts of expenses of preparation for trial and so on, so that depending on the jurisdiction you're in, you may be lucky to walk out with $75,000 or $60,000 after you pay all these things, which means that you didn't get anything close to the full fair market value as determined by the court.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons, I assume, Ken, why people are going to ask for more than they really thought they were going to get to cover the things. Am I right?
Well, they're not compensatory. They try, but the thing, you have to remember that there's a lot of common sense to it. Believe it or not, we, Ken and I, are not magicians. We can't turn a jury's mind to putty. You have to have the evidence. So what happens is that it's just part of the process.
Well, we all have part of the process, and I'm turning that viewer's mind to putty because we're out of time. Julie, and thank you so much, and thank you for coming in from L.A. Ken, thank you for being here as well. Now, I hope that you never face this issue, but I also hope that you'll be vigilant regarding how eminent domain is used in your community.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.